Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and let's see. By my count, there are three more weekends left till Labor Day. Still time to squeeze in the last of your summer reading. In my research to present you with top titles, I've noticed so many of the books on the bestseller list are recent additions to popular series. Well, okay, we all agree that sitting down with a new adventure of a well-loved hero is a great way to while away the hours. So, let's turn to page one of the book report with this spotlight on the summer serials.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Karen Slaughter's new thriller, Criminal, book 6 in the Will Trent series, is an epic tale of love, loyalty, and murder that encompasses 40 years, two chillingly similar murder cases, and a good man's deepest secrets. Check BookReportRadio.com on August 6, 2011, for a preview of Fallen, book 5 in this series. Will Trent is a brilliant agent with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. Newly in love, he is beginning to put a difficult past behind him. Then a college student goes missing, and he is inexplicably kept off the case by his supervisor and mentor, Deputy Director Amanda Wagner. Will cannot fathom Amanda's motivation until the two of them literally collide in an abandoned orphanage they've both been drawn to for different reasons. Flashback nearly 40 years. In the summer Will Trent was born, Amanda Wagner is a newbie in the Atlanta PD. One of her first cases is to investigate a brutal crime in one of the city's worst neighborhoods. Amanda and her partner seem to be the only ones who care if an arrest is ever made. Now the case that launched Amanda's career has suddenly come back to life, and it is intertwined with the long-held mystery of Will's birth and parentage. And each will need to face down demons from the past if they are to prevent an even greater terror from being unleashed today. Kathleen Early narrates.
A cinnamon-brown Oldsmobile Cutlass crawled up Edgewood Avenue, the windows lowered. The driver hunched down in his seat. The lights from the console showed narrow, beady eyes tracing along the line of girls standing under the street sign. Jane, Mary, Lydia. The car stopped. Predictably, the man tilted up his chin toward Kitty. She trotted over, adjusting her miniskirt as she navigated her spiked heels across the uneven asphalt. 2 weeks ago, when Juice had first brought Kitty onto the corner, she told the other girl she was 16, which probably meant 15, though she looked no older than 12. They had all hated her on sight. Kitty leaned down into the open window of the car, her stiff vinyl skirt tipped up like the bottom of a bell. She always got picked first, which was becoming a problem that everyone but Juice could see. Kitty got special favors. She could talk men into doing anything. The girl was fresh, childlike, though like all of them, she carried a kitchen knife in her purse and knew how to use it. Nobody wanted to do what they were doing. But to have another girl, a newer girl, picked over them, hurt just as much as if they were all standing on the sidelines at the debutante ball. Inside the Oldsmobile, the transaction was quickly negotiated. No haggling, because what was on offer was still worth the price. Kitty made the signal to Juice, waited for his nod, then got into the car. The muffler chugged exhaust as the Olds made a wide turn onto a narrow side street. The car shook once as the gear was shoved into park. The driver's hand flew up, clamped around the back of Kitty's head, and she disappeared. Lucy Bennett turned away, looking up the dark, soulless avenue. No headlights coming. No traffic. No business. Atlanta wasn't a nighttime town. The last person to leave the Equitable Building usually turned off the lights. But Lucy could see the bulbs from the Flatiron glowing clear across Central City Park. If she squinted hard enough, she could find the familiar green of the C&S sign that anchored the business district. The New South. Progress through commerce. The city too busy to hate. If there were men out walking these streets tonight, it was with no amount of good on their minds. Jane lit a smoke, then tucked the pack back into her purse. She wasn't the kind to share, but she certainly was the kind to take.
That was Criminal by Karen Slaughter. Readers, I'm thrilled to welcome New York Times bestselling author Daniel Silva back to the Book Report. Silva burst onto the literary scene in 1997 with his best-selling debut, The Unlikely Spy. But it would be Silva's fourth novel, The Kill Artist, that would alter the course of his career. The novel featured the art restorer and sometime Israeli spy Gabriel Alon. The just-released Fallen Angel, it's the 12th novel in the series. Silva knew from an early age he wanted to become a writer, but his first profession would be journalism. Born in Michigan, raised and educated in California, he was hired on as a temp in 1984 by UPI to help cover that year's Democratic National Convention. Later that year, Silva joined UPI full-time, working first in San Francisco, then on the foreign desk in Washington, and finally as Mideast correspondent in Cairo and the Persian Gulf. Silva returned to D.C. to work for CNN and became executive producer of its talk show unit, including shows like Crossfire, Capital Gang, and Reliable Sources. Silva left CNN in 1997 and began writing full-time. Since then, all of his books have been bestsellers. Welcome, Daniel. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report today.
Thank you, Elaine. Thanks for having me.
What was it like for you to hear that President Clinton has chosen Gabriel as his favorite fictional character?
Deeply humbling. Look, what any time that someone says to me, you're my favorite author, or Gabriel Alon is my favorite character, I'm just blown away by that. But when President Clinton made that declaration a few months ago, I was just astonished and as I said, humbled. He is a voracious reader, but he also knows an extraordinary amount about the Middle East and about Israel. And so if he can appreciate Gabriel Alon and accept Gabriel Alon, you know, I must have done something right in creating that character.
I'll say. Does the title of your new book, The Fallen Angel, refer back to Gabriel?
I think there are a couple of fallen angels in this book. So in the end, I'm not sure if it really refers to Gabriel or to a woman named Claudia Andreotti, a curator from the Vatican Museums who falls from the dome of St. Peter's Basilica at the beginning of the book.
Yeah. So many of your books seem to have the Vatican as a setting. What is it about it that keeps drawing you back?
Well, it first appeared in the series, in the third book of the series, in a book called The Confessor. It was a book that explored the conduct of the Vatican during the Second World War. And I just fell in love with the place. I also fell in love that I created for that book. And as you said, they have appeared in numerous books since, and they were prominent in The Messenger especially. But this is really, in this book, Gabriel is working behind the walls of the Vatican, restoring a Caravaggio masterpiece as the book opens. And I just, you know, I spent as much time behind the walls of the Vatican as I could when I was researching the book. And, you know, I just find the Vatican to be absolutely irresistible.
Well, your books are so incredible in the depth and breadth of the historical detail that you provide. How long does it take you to do all the research?
It's difficult to say. I do a lot of research while I'm thinking through a book. I do a lot of travel and talking to people, and then I'm researching as I'm writing. So it's pretty much a you know, it runs the length of the book. I do it in tandem with writing. You know, when I was writing the climax of The Fallen Angel, which takes place in the old city of Jerusalem, and without giving too much away, under the old city of Jerusalem, my office looked like, you know, there were books and maps and charts and just scattered all over the place. It was a great deal of work went into trying to get that scene right.
Yeah. In the book, you write that the Table Mount Plateau in Jerusalem is actually very unstable. Why is that?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it was destabilized a few years ago when the Islamic Waqf, which controls the actual Temple Mount Plateau, the Israelis left the mount in the hands of the Muslims when they conquered East Jerusalem in 1967 in the Six-Day War. An underground area known as Solomon's Stables was converted into a massive underground mosque, and the construction destabilized that corner of the Temple Mount, caused the southern wall of the Temple Mount Plateau to bulge, and so it is possible that actually could collapse at some point. That would be a disaster, potentially an extremely dangerous disaster. But something else also happened during the construction of that mosque, and that is that the workmen for the Waqf, the Islamic Authority, dug up a great deal of earth from the Temple Mount and simply hurled it over the side of the walls into the Kidron Valley or took it to the dump. And as you might imagine, earth from the Temple Mount is filled with all kinds of artifacts, and they were dislodged and sort of, you know, treated very badly. And it was an archaeological crime.
The book talks about temple denial. Do you want to tell us a little about that?
Well, temple denial is sort of mainstream thinking within the Islamic world and the Palestinian leadership these days. It is the contention, we'll call it, the contention that there was never actually a Jewish temple on the Temple Mount. And it clearly has a purpose to further attempt to delegitimize the state of Israel and Israel's broader right to exist. And I think it is a kind of a first cousin to Holocaust denial. So if your contention is that there was no Holocaust and that there was never a Jewish presence or Jewish temple in Jerusalem, then it's a shortstop to that the state of Israel has no right to exist.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking. The Fallen Angel deals with the provenance of major artworks and some of their kind of checkered past, if you will. Are national museums actually grappling with this issue about their collections?
Well, we know, look, there are some very famous cases. The Euphronius Crater of the Met, there dubious sources and had dubious provenances. And, you know, there's been a sea change in the last few decades that, you know, the source countries for these antiquities have become much more aggressive in trying to protect them and to reclaim them. And so some prominent museums in this country really got their fingers burned in this process.
And this leads into the discussion about cultural patrimony. You want to talk about that?
Well, cultural patrimony is a term to describe that, you know, items that countries feel are part of their heritage and their possessions. You know, the Italians are descendants of the Etruscans and the Romans, and therefore they rightly claim that Etruscan and Roman artifacts from their soil are rightly theirs. And they have brought enormous resources and energy to bear in the last couple of decades trying to make sure that smugglers don't rip them out of the ground and sell them on the black market, and that antiquities that are out there that were sold and put into circulation after the international treaties went into effect in the 70s, that they're trying to get those things back. And it's a very interesting story and a difficult question.
So in the book, the Hezbollah figures prominently, and they're dealing in antiquity smuggling. Is this really based on fact?
I would say it's inspired by fact. Hezbollah has an enormous criminal operation, global criminal operation, to finance its terrorism networks and its arms procurements and its operations inside Lebanon. They are into drug smuggling, diamond smuggling, human trafficking, black market cigarettes, pirated DVDs, you name it. One U.S. official described them as the Gambinos on steroids. So to me, it was a short leap to suggest in a novel that Hezbollah, which is of course based in Lebanon, and throughout the Middle East, that they could be involved in antiquity smuggling. And I think deep down, I think I'd actually believe it.
It seems like it could be. So what's next for Gabriel?
You know, I learned a long time ago not to discuss a book that isn't written.
Okay.
So what is next? What is next for Daniel is that Daniel will spend the next couple of weeks hopscotching around the country promoting this novel. Then I'll take a week off and recover, and then decide what the next book is going to be. And then I'll go back to Washington, close the door, and start writing it. So I don't know exactly what is next.
Oh, and I also read in your biography that there might be some laundry fluffing as well.
Well, my office is in the basement of our house, right next to the laundry room. And so one of the ways that I give myself little breaks during the day is that I am responsible for the laundry at home. Very glamorous life being in an office. And I actually find that folding is a very relaxing, distracting thing. And so when the kids come home from school, their laundry is waiting in a nice, neat little pile for them.
All right. And is Gabriel headed to the big screen?
Well, we're working on it. It is a difficult process to try to take a series character like Gabriel Alon and get all the deals done and everything that needs to be put in place to get that project launched. And all I can say is that we are working on it. There's some very interesting possibilities, and stay tuned.
All right. Well, Gabriel is worth waiting for. I love The Fallen Angel. I encourage all
thank
our
you.
Listeners to pick it up. And thanks so much for joining us today. And now, let's hear a sampling of The Fallen Angel, performed by George Guidel.
He ran the Restorer's ID badge through the magnetic card swipe and motioned for him to pass through the metal detector. When the machine emitted a shrill pinging, the Restorer stopped in his tracks and nodded wearily at the gendarme's computer. On the screen, next to the restorer's unsmiling photograph, was a special notice written by the chief of the Vatican Security Office. The gendarme read it twice to make certain he understood it correctly, then, looking up, found himself staring directly into the restorer's unusually green eyes. Something about the calmness of his expression and the hint of a mischievous smile caused the officer to give an involuntary shiver. He nodded toward the next set of doors and watched intently as the restorer passed through them without a sound. So, the gendarme thought, the rumors were true. Gabriel Allon, renowned restorer of old master paintings, retired Israeli spy and assassin, and savior of the Holy Father, had returned to the Vatican. With a single keystroke, the officer cleared the file from the screen. Then he made the sign of the cross, and for the first time in many years, recited the act of contrition. It was an odd choice, he thought, because he was guilty of no sin other than curiosity. But surely that was to be forgiven. After all, it wasn't every day a lowly Vatican policeman had the chance to gaze into the face of a legend. Fluorescent lights, dimmed to their night settings, hummed softly as Gabriel entered the main conservation lab of the Vatican Picture Gallery. As usual, he was the first to arrive. He closed the door and waited for the reassuring thud of the automatic locks, then made his way along a row of storage cabinets toward the floor-to-ceiling black curtains at the far end of the room. A small sign warned the area beyond the curtains was strictly off-limits. After slipping through the breach, Gabriel went immediately to his trolley and carefully examined the disposition of his supplies. His containers of pigment and medium were precisely as he had left them. So were his Winsor & Newton Series 7 sable brushes, including the one with a telltale spot of azure near the tip that he always left at a precise 30-degree angle relative to the others. It suggested the cleaning staff had once again resisted the temptation to enter his workspace. He doubted whether his colleagues had shown similar restraint. In fact, he had it on the highest authority that his tiny curtained enclave had displaced the espresso machine in the break room as the most popular gathering spot for museum staff. He removed his leather jacket and switched on a pair of standing halogen lamps. The Deposition of Christ, widely regarded as Caravaggio's finest painting, glowed under the intense white light. Gabriel stood motionless before the towering canvas for several minutes, hand pressed to his chin, head tilted to one side, eyes fixed on the haunting image. Nicodemus, muscular and barefoot, stared directly back as he carefully lowered the pale, lifeless body of Christ toward the slab of funerary stone where it would be prepared for entombment. Next to Nicodemus was John the Evangelist, who, in his desperation to touch his beloved teacher one last time, had inadvertently opened the wound in the Savior's side. Watching silently over them were the Madonna and the Magdalene, their heads bowed, while Mary of Cleophas raised her arms toward the heavens in lamentation. It was a work of both immense sorrow and tenderness, made more striking by Caravaggio's revolutionary use of light. Even Gabriel, who had been toiling over the painting for weeks, always felt as though he were intruding on a heartbreaking moment of private anguish. The painting had darkened with age, particularly along the left side of the canvas, where the entrance of the tomb had once been clearly visible. There were some in the Italian art establishment, including Giacomo Benedetti, the famed Caravaggista from the Istituto Centrale per il Restauro, who wondered whether the tomb should be returned to prominence. Benedetti had been forced to share his opinion with a reporter from La Repubblica because the restorer chosen for the project had, for inexplicable reasons, failed to seek his advice before commencing work. What's more, Benedetti found it disheartening that the museum had refused to make public the restorer's identity. For many days, the papers had bristled with familiar calls for the Vatican to lift the veil of silence.
That was The Fallen Angel by Daniel Silva.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Award-winning author Charlaine Harris has earned a devoted fan base with her best-selling Sookie Stackhouse Southern Vampire Mystery Series. Though deadlocked, a Sookie Stackhouse novel, Book 12, is currently on the New York Times bestseller list, I decided to bring you a sampling of Altogether Dead, Book 7, which seems to be a true reader favorite. Altogether Dead features more dark but frequently hilarious adventures of the buxom, blonde, beautiful, and telepathic cocktail waitress, Sookie, who prefers the company of vampires to that of the living. The book report doesn't usually bring you books about the undead, but this series is so popular, I felt we had to undo that restriction. Johanna Parker narrates.
My delicious brother is making noises about getting married, like everyone else in Bon Ton, I said.
You sound a bit depressed.
Pam cocked her head to one side and regarded me like a sparrow eyeing a worm. Well, maybe a tad wee bit, I said.
You must keep busy, Pam said. Then you won't have time to mope.
Pam loved Dear Abby. Lots of vampires scrutinize the column daily. Their solutions to some of the writer's problems would just make you scream. Literally. Pam had already advised me that I could only be imposed on if I permitted it, and that I needed to be more selective in picking my friends. I was getting emotional health counseling from a vampire. I am, I said. Keeping busy, that is. I'm working, I've still got my roommate from New Orleans, and I'm going to a wedding shower tomorrow, not for Jason and Crystal, another couple.
Pam had paused, her hand on the doorknob of Eric's office. She considered my statement, her brows drawn together.
I am not remembering what a wedding shower is, though I've heard of it, she said.
She brightened.
They'll get married in a bathroom? No, I've heard the term before, surely. A woman wrote to Abby that she hadn't gotten a thank you note for a large shower gift. They get presents?
You got it, I said. A shower is a party for someone who's about to get married. Sometimes a shower is for the couple, and they're both there. But usually only the bride is the honoree, and all the other people at the party are women. Everyone brings a gift. The theory is that this way the couple can start life with everything they need. We do the same thing when a couple's expecting a baby. Of course, then it's a baby shower.
Baby showers, Pam repeated. She smiled in a chilly way. It was enough to put frost on your pumpkin, seeing that upcurve of the lips. I like the term, she said.
She knocked on Eric's office door and then opened it.
Eric, she said. Maybe someday one of the waitresses will get pregnant and we can go to a baby shower.
That would be something to see, said Eric, lifting his golden head from the papers on his desk.
The sheriff registered my presence, gave me a hard look, and decided to ignore me. Eric and I had issues. Despite the fact that the room was full of people waiting for his attention, Eric lay down his pen and stood to stretch his tall and magnificent body, perhaps for my benefit. As usual, Eric was in tight jeans and a Fangtasia t-shirt, black with the white stylized fangs that the bar used as its trademark. Fangtasia was written in jazzy red script across the white points in the same style as the neon sign outside. If Eric turned around, the back would read, The Bar with a Bite.
Pam had given me one when Fangtasia first got into marketing its own stuff. Eric made the shirt look good, and I remembered all too well what was underneath it. I tore my gaze away from Eric's stretch to look around the room. There were lots of other vampires crammed into the smallish space, but till you saw them, you didn't know they were there. They were so still and silent. Clancy, the bar manager, had claimed one of the two visitor chairs before the desk. Clancy had just barely survived the previous year's witch war, but he hadn't come out unscathed. The witches had drained Clancy near to the point of no return. By the time Eric discovered Clancy, tracing his smell to a Shreveport cemetery, Clancy was one vacutainer short of dead. During his long recovery, the red-haired vamp had grown bitter and snappish. Now he grinned at me, showing some fang.
"You can sit in my lap, Sookie,"
he said, patting his thighs. I smiled back, but not like my heart was in it.
That was Altogether Dead by Charlaine Harris. John Sanford's top cop, Lucas Davenport, has seen many terrible murder scenes. But the one he faces in Stolen Prey, book 22 in the series, is one of the worst. For a listen to book one in this series, Rules of Prey, check bookreportradio.com, week of July 14th, 2012. In a small Minnesota town, an entire family has been killed. Husband, wife, two daughters, even the family pets. There's something about the scene that pokes at Lucas's cop instincts. It looks like the kind of scorched earth retribution he's seen in drug killings. But this is a seriously upscale town, and the husband was an executive vice president at a big bank. It just doesn't seem to fit. Until it does. And where it leads Lucas will take him into the darkest nightmare of his life. Richard Ferrone narrates.
The BCA superintendent, who didn't particularly like Lucas but found him to be a valuable foil when it came to dealing with political issues, called him at home as Lucas was working his way through the Times and a bowl of steel-cut oatmeal, which his wife and daughter said was good for something. It was organic and saved the whales or lowered his cholesterol. One of those things. He yearned for a simple glazed donut. But not if it doomed Mother Earth. His cell phone began ringing and simultaneously rattling like a snake on the table next to his hand. "Really big trouble," the superintendent said. "There's going to be a lot of media. Schaffer and his crew are on the way. You'd better get out there too so you're up to speed. I'm trying to find Rosemarie to tell her about it." "Murder," he said. "An entire family slaughtered." Lucas backed the Porsche out of his garage and found a gray sky and a cool day going cold. Rain coming, disturbing the summer, hinting at what all Minnesotans knew in their bones. Winter always comes. The death house sat down a leafy blacktopped lane, a stone, brick, and whiteboard lakeside palace where the great Gatsby might have lived, made for summer soirees with mimosas and mint juleps. The deep green summer trees grew in close and dense, so thick that even nearby noises seemed muffled and distant, and a perfect lawn dropped down a gentle slope to Lake Minnetonka. A floating dock stuck into the lake like a finger. A fast fiberglass cruiser was tied to one side of the dock, an oversized pontoon boat to the other, ready to party. The scene was dead quiet, except for the moaning wind in the trees. The incoming clouds were so gray and low, the house so touched with a cool decorator chic, a tightness, a foreboding, that a Hollywood camera corkscrewing down the lane to the front door would have automatically hinted at horrors to be found behind the well-scrubbed window glass. A crazy housewife with poison, a husband with a meat cleaver in his hand, a couple of robotic kids with a long-barreled revolver and blank gray eyes. None of which would have done justice to the real horror behind the doors. Lucas got to the house at a little after 11 o'clock in the morning and walked back out on the front porch 5 minutes later, looking for a breath of fresh air and maybe a place to spit to get the taste of death out of his mouth. He was a tall, hard, very rich man with broad shoulders and a hawkish nose, wearing a $200 white shirt and a dark blue purple label suit with a red Hermes necktie, the necktie twisted and pulled loose behind the knot. His face was tanned, and the thin white line of a scar dropped across one eyebrow onto his cheek. Another white scar showed in the pit of his neck, where a young girl, barely into her teens, had shot him with a street pistol that he hadn't seen coming. He rubbed his face with the fingers of his left hand, which protruded from a slightly dirty-looking cast. Del Capslock followed him out onto the porch. Del looked back over his shoulder and said, "I don't think I've ever been to a crime scene this quiet." "What are you gonna say?" Lucas asked. He sniffed at the cast. Nasty. He needed to wash it again. "You know what freaked me out?" Del asked. "It wasn't the kids. It was the dogs. The dogs couldn't tell us anything. They weren't witnesses. They weren't attack dogs. Two miniature poodles and a golden retriever? They killed them anyway. Hunted them down. They were killing everything. Because they liked it." "I don't know. There's a lot going on in there," Lucas said. "Maybe they killed the dogs first to extort information. Went around and shot them just to prove that they'd do it. Then the boy, then the wife and daughter, then the guy. They wanted something from the guy." "We don't know they did it that way," Del said. Del was too thin. Grizzled, some would say. Unshaven, dressed in jeans and a T-shirt and Nike cross trainers. The T-shirt said Menards, which was a local building supply chain. His comment reflected an ingrained skepticism about any unsupported assertion. He wanted facts.
That was Stolen Prey by John Sanford.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Bell, Book 19 in James Lee Burke's Dave Robicheaux series, begins with Dave in a recovery unit in New Orleans. A Creole girl named T. Jolie Melton visits him and leaves him an iPod with the country blues song Creole Bell on it. Then she disappears. Dave becomes obsessed with the song and the memory of T. Jolie. He sets off in search of her sister, who later turns up inside a block of ice floating in the Gulf. To quote the Booklist review, Creole Bell plays out with intimations of mortality and melancholy musings on the pillaging of the South Louisiana Bayou. But as always, Burke brings something new to the table. Dave and Cleet may still be unbowed, but they are certainly broken, and all the more interesting for it, unquote. Will Patton narrates.
For the rest of the world, the season was still fall, marked by cool nights and the gold-green remnants of summer. For me, down in South Louisiana, in the Garden District of New Orleans, the wetlands that lay far beyond my hospital window had turned to winter, one characterized by stricken woods that were drained of water and strung with a web of gray leaves and dead air vines that had wrapped themselves as tightly as cord around the trees. Those who have had the following experience will not find my descriptions exaggerated or even metaphorical in nature. A morphine dream has neither walls, nor a ceiling, nor a floor. The sleep it provides is like a warm bath, free of concerns about mortality and pain and memories from the past. Morpheus also allows us vision through a third eye that we never knew existed. His acolytes can see through time and become participants in grand events they had believed accessible only through history books and films. On one occasion, I saw a hot air balloon rising from its tether in Audubon Park, a uniformed soldier operating a telegrapher's key inside the wicker basket, while down below other members of the Confederate Signal Corps shared sandwiches and drank coffee from tin cups, all of them as stately and stiff as figures in a sepia-tinted photograph. I don't wish to be too romantic about my experience in the recovery facility there on St. Charles Avenue in Uptown New Orleans. While I gazed through my window at the wonderful green streetcar wobbling down the tracks on the neutral ground, the river fog puffing out of the live oak trees, the pink and purple neon on the Katz and Bestoff drugstore, as effervescent as tentacles of smoke twirling from marker grenades, I knew, with a sinking heart, that what I was seeing was an illusion, that in reality the Katz and Bestoff drugstore and the umbrella-covered snowball carts along St. Charles and the musical gaiety of the city had slipped into history long ago, and somewhere out on the edge of my vision, the onset of permanent winter waited for me. Though I'm a believer, that did not lessen the sense of trepidation I experienced in these moments. I felt as if the sun were burning a hole in the sky, causing it to blacken and collapse like a giant sheet of carbon paper suddenly crinkling and folding in on itself, and I had no power to reverse the process. I felt that a great darkness was spreading across the land, not unlike ink spilling across the face of a topographic map. Many years ago, when I was recovering from wounds I received in a Southeast Asian country, a United States Army psychiatrist told me that my morphine-induced dreams were creating what he called a world destruction fantasy, one that had its origins in childhood and the dissolution of one's natal family. He was a scientist and a learned man, and I did not argue with him. Even at night, when I lay in a berth on a hospital ship, far from free fire zones and the sound of ammunition belts popping under a burning hooch, I did not argue. Nor did I contend with the knowledge of the psychiatrist when dead members of my platoon spoke to me in the rain and a mermaid with an Asian face beckoned to me from a coral cave strung with pink fans, her hips spangled with yellow coins, her mouth parting, her naked breast. The cult of Morpheus is a strange community indeed, and it requires that one take up residence in a country where the improbable becomes commonplace. No matter what I did, nor how many times I disappeared out my window into the mists along St. Charles Avenue, back into an era of rooftop jazz bands and historical streetcars filled with men in bowler hats and women who carried parasols, the watery gray rim of a blighted planet was always out there, intransigent and corrupt.
That was Creole Bell by James Lee Burke. The Fear Artist is the latest in Timothy Hallinan's Polk Rafferty series. The book report takes you back to Book 3, Breathing Water, which seems to be a top choice for many Polk fans. A late-night poker game in Bangkok nets American expat writer Polk Rafferty the opportunity to write the biography of Khun Pan, a flamboyant, vulgar, self-made billionaire with a criminal past and far-reaching political ambitions. Within hours, Rafferty, his wife, their adopted daughter, and Polk's best friend have become disposable pawns in a brutal power struggle among some of Thailand's richest, most ruthless citizens. There are those who would go to any length to ensure the book is never written, and others equally desperate to have Pond's darkest secrets exposed. Suddenly, Rafferty is sinking deeper in a perilous sea of treachery and intrigue and caught up in the inhumane machinations of an Asian baby-selling ring as he searches frantically for the only chance he may have to get everyone he loves out alive. Victor Bevan narrates.
Rafferty barely hears him. If he were forced at gunpoint to make an estimate, and it's looking increasingly likely that someone will be at gunpoint soon, Rafferty would put the value of the chips in the pot somewhere in the neighborhood of 750,000 baht, about $24,000 U.S. Not exactly the national debt, but certainly the largest amount he's ever risked on the turn of a card. Of course, he's only been playing for 10 days. Feeling the big guy's eyes on him, he grabs 8 of the chips off his stack and clicks them together 4 times. He does his best to make the gesture seem natural, but it feels like the staged business it is. Transparently phony, bad blocking in an amateur play. He closes his hand around the chips and finds them wet with sweat. The big guy leans back in his chair, his pink mouth puckering around his cigar. The bodyguards watch everyone else. The man 3 seats to Rafferty's right had dealt the hand. He's a sallow-faced man in a shiny suit that's either brown or green, depending on the light, but not a good shade of either. He waits indifferently for the man to his left to make his move. The man, one of the businessmen, makes a tight little mouth like a reluctant kiss and throws in a couple thousand. The uniformed man on the businessman's other side, Rafferty's friend Artit, has the bet in hand and tosses it into the pot with the air of someone making a donation at the temple of an unreliable god. The moment Rafferty has been dreading has arrived. He tries to look thoughtful as he waits to be told what to do. The one whose job it is to tell him, seated directly opposite him at the round green felt table, is as lean as a matador and as dark as a used tea bag, with a hatchet-narrow face and hair that has been dyed so black it has blue highlights. With his eyes resting lazily on the pile of chips in the center of the table, he turns the signet ring on his right hand so the stone is beneath his finger, and then brings it back up again. The hum in Rafferty's ears rises in pitch, as though the power line has been stretched tighter. The room seems to brighten. It takes all of Rafferty's willpower to keep his hands steady as he pushes his entire pile of chips toward the center of the green felt. He says, "I'm all in." There is a general shifting around the table as people adjust themselves in their chairs and survey the new landscape of risk. Rafferty has about 290,000 baht in chips. He's been having a selectively good night, just barely not good enough to be suspicious. This is a bet that could remove at least 2 of the players from the game. One of them is the big guy. 4 days ago, when this game was being planned, there had been only 3 people in the room. Rafferty, Artit, and the hatchet-faced man. They had been sitting in a dingy meeting room in a police station. A room to which the hatchet-faced man had been brought directly from his jail cell. He'd been promised 6 months off his sentence if he succeeded in fooling the pigeons, the businessmen, at the table, thereby guaranteeing that he'd do his best with the 4 dodges he was to perform during the game. Artit and the other policeman, whose name is Cosset, had been promised a consideration of 50,000 baht apiece by the casino owners who were looking for ways to spot the dodges and for whose enlightenment the game is secretly being videotaped. But no one had expected the big guy. And now, seated to Rafferty's left, he blows out a quart of cigar smoke and leans back in his chair. His eyes flick to Rafferty again and then away. Late 40s, strong as a horse beneath 15 pounds of soft, wet fat, he holds the cigar dead center in a tightly pursed mouth. He says in English, "Bluff." "Easy to find out," Rafferty says. His heart is beating so hard he can actually feel the cloth of his shirt brush his chest. A cloud of smoke waved away so the big guy can peer down at Rafferty's chips. "How much is that, Farang?"
292,000, Rafferty says.
I've only got 285.
In or out? Asks the dealer.
In,
says the big guy. He pushes his chips into the center of the felt, and then drops the last few 1,000 baht chips on top of the pile, one at a time. Then he switches to Tai.
Look at your money, he says, because you're never going to see it again.
That was Breathing Water by Timothy Hallinan.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
So, I'm sitting in a movie theater watching the previews before Batman. Hey, you expect me to be up on popular culture, right? And what do I see? A preview of Tom Cruise in a car chase, beating up thugs, and generally being one bad dude. And I'm thinking, here's a movie right on the top of my give it a miss list. Then the name of the movie flashes on the screen and I am thunderstruck. Jack Reacher. What in the world? Say it isn't so. If you've ever read any of Lee Child's Jack Reacher books, and there have been 16 of them, I am sure that, like me, you're thinking Tom Cruise as Jack Reacher? No flippin' way. This is a casting travesty of epic proportion. Oh well. Reacher fans, best to console yourself with a new Reacher novel. So, may I present The Affair, which takes us back to Reacher's early days. For elite military cop Reacher, that somewhere was Carter Crossing, Mississippi, in 1997. A lonely railroad track, a crime scene, a cover-up. A young woman is dead, and solid evidence points to a soldier at a nearby military base. But that soldier has powerful friends in Washington. Reacher is ordered undercover to find out everything he can, to control the local police, and then to vanish. Reacher is a good soldier, but when he gets to Carter Crossing, he finds layers no one saw coming, and the investigation spins out of control. Local Sheriff Elizabeth Devereaux has a thirst for justice and an appetite for secrets. Uncertain they can trust one another, Reacher and Devereaux reluctantly join forces. Reacher works to uncover the truth while others try to bury it. The conspiracy threatens to shatter his faith in his mission and turn him into a man to be feared. Dick Hill narrates.
Seven letters. Reacher. Or 11 letters. Arrest me now. The guy at the inquiry desk said, Colonel John James Fraser is in 3C315. You know how to get there? I said, yes. Third floor, C ring, nearest to radial corridor number 3, bay number 15. The Pentagon's version of map coordinates, which it needed, given that it covered 29 whole acres of floor space. The guy said, Sir, you have a great day. And his guileless gaze moved past my shoulder to the next in line. I stood still for a moment. They were tying it up with a bow. They were making it perfect. The general common law test for criminal culpability is expressed by the Latin
Actus non facit reum nisi mens sit rea, which means, roughly, doing things won't necessarily get you in trouble unless you actually mean to do them. Action plus intention is the standard. They were waiting for me to prove my intention. They were waiting for me to step through the turnstile and into the labyrinth, which explained why the four spare guys were on their side of the gate, not mine. Crossing the line would make it real. Maybe there were jurisdiction issues. Maybe lawyers had been consulted. Fraser wanted my for sure, but he wanted his own just as much. I took another breath and crossed the line and made it real. I walked between the two badge checkers and squeezed between the cold alloy planks of the turnstile. The bar was retracted. There was nothing to hit with my thighs. I stepped out on the far side and paused. The four spare guys were on my right. I looked at their shoes. Army regulations are surprisingly vague about shoes. Plain black lace-up Oxfords or close equivalents, conservative, no designs on them, minimum of three pairs of eyelets, closed toe, maximum two-inch heel. That's all the fine print says. The four guys on my right were all in compliance, but they weren't wearing cop shoes, not like the two guys outside. They were sporting four variations on the same classic theme. High shines, tight laces, a little creasing and wear here and there. Maybe they were genuine DPS. Maybe they weren't. No way of telling. Not right then. I was looking at them, and they were looking at me, but no one spoke. I looped around them and headed deeper into the building. I used the E-ring counterclockwise and turned left at the first radial hallway. The four guys followed. They stayed about 60 feet behind me, close enough to keep me in sight, far enough back not to crowd me. A maximum 7 minutes between any two points. I was the meat in a sandwich. I figured there would be another crew waiting outside 3C315, or as close to it as they decided to let me get. I was heading straight for them. Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. I used some stairs on the D-ring and went up two flights to the third floor. I changed to a clockwise direction, just for the fun of it, and passed radial corridor number 5 and then 4. The D-ring was busy. People were bustling from place to place with armfuls of khaki files. Blank-eyed men and women in uniform were stepping smartly. The place was congested. I dodged and sidestepped and kept on going. People looked at me every step of the way. The hair and the beard. I stopped at a water fountain and bent down and took a drink. People passed me by. 60 feet behind me, the four spare DPS guys were nowhere to be seen. But then, they didn't really need to tail me. They knew where I was going, and they knew what time I was supposed to get there.
We've just heard The Affair by Lee Child. Readers, I hope the show brought you up to date with adventures of favorite characters and maybe introduced you to some new heroes you'll want to follow. Reading a new installment with a character you enjoy is like catching up with an old friend. Of course, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for more ideas. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.